This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. And to follow up on the theme I've been kind of working on for several weeks now is logical fallacies, trying to get individuals to be aware that sometimes what seems to be common sense or a reasonable argument falls apart when we're arguing with each other or trying to convince somebody of something. Make sure you're asking, is this logical and what's their evidence? It's very, just ask those two questions every time you hear an argument. You hear a professional on this program, ask yourself those questions. What we're trying to do is give you the best information and then kind of expand it into how do we know what we know a little bit with this idea of logical fallacies. The one I want to talk about today is relatively common in certain aspects of life, and it's called the straw man argument. What's going on in the straw man argument is something that politicians do all the time. Politician wants to attack somebody's part or place, and what they do is they make up a position that their opponent has, but the opponent really doesn't have that position. They say that the opponent has that position because it's easier to attack than the opponent's real position. For example, and I'm using this purely as an example, Obama may have attacked McCain about his conservative leanings and how those conservative leanings have led us to the financial situation we're in now. I'm not making any choices, saying one thing or the other, but that may not have had anything to do with what McCain's policies were, where he voted on things. So the straw man is somebody making up a position which was really not real but easier to argue against. And you got to be careful about those, particularly in politics is where I see that the most. Today we're going to be discussing pediatric urology, diseases and disorders and problems of the urinary tract and urinary system in pediatrics with David Bomolowski. Dr. Bomolowski is the only board-certified pediatric urologist in Alaska. He trained at the Air Force Academy initially, got his MD and internship and urologic residency training, then went to the University of Michigan where he was specifically trained in pediatric urology. Spent a number of years in the military as the only pediatric urologist in the Air Force before coming into private practice here about 18 months ago. Dr. Bomolowski, welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
So why do we need to talk about pediatric urology? What is that and why is it a subspecialty?
Well, a pediatric urologist is a physician who takes care of children who have diseases of the genitals or urinary tract. In a nutshell, what I like to tell families is essentially I take care of bad plumbing in children. Mm-hmm. Most commonly associated with adult diseases, but over the last 30 years, it's become apparent that children have unique issues related to the urinary tract that deserve special attention.
So just to put this in some anatomical perspective, we have these kidneys sitting deep in our abdomen, and they filter blood, make urine, and that blood comes from – that makes the urine's made in the kidney and goes down the ureters into our bladder. And the bladder's a muscle that contracts, and we urinate out through our urethra.
That's the plumbing. Right. Unfortunately, the urinary tract tends to be one of the more common locations for congenital problems, mm-hmm. Starting all the way at the top of the kidney, as you mentioned, on down. So the kidney itself may be a site of obstruction or dysplasia or malformation. That tube that drains from the kidney down to the bladder, that ureter oftentimes may have a malformation. It may have inserted in a wrong location. It may have a blockage to it. The bladder may have anatomic problems with it. It may have functional problems where the anatomy may be correct, but the usage of that bladder may be causing infections or incontinence or other issues. And then finally, the urethra, the tube that leads from the bladder, may be malformed as well. And in addition to that, there are the internal genitalia to include the testicles. The testicles normally descend shortly before birth. A common urologic malformation is an undescended testicle, one that doesn't quite make it. So essentially, it's the urinary tract and the genitalia.
For those of you who are listening, again, this is Line 1. My guest is Dr. David Bobulaski, and we're going to be talking about all those organs that we just identified and the problems that happen in the pediatric age group. However, if you've got questions or comments or experiences you want to share with us, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us over the next 55 minutes or so. In Anchorage, our toll-free number is 550-8433, 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, and you can write it out, LINEONE, all at one word, at kska.org. And remember, we'll only be here until just before 3 o'clock today. If you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. It is true that a large percentage, something that I remember, 3 to 5% of all children are born with some kind of congenital anomaly. Most of those are pretty mild, but certainly urinary tract abnormalities are very common in that group. Why is that? Do you have any particular ideas, or have you been taught anything?
Well, as we were discussing before the show, one of the really fun aspects of my job is I sometimes get to meet my patients before they're born. and that's because about 1 out of every 1,000 pregnancies is associated with hydronephrosis, or a dilated kidney. Okay. And oftentimes that's picked up on a prenatal ultrasound. As a matter of fact, that is the number one abnormality picked up on a prenatal ultrasound. And, oftentimes it's something that we pick up and we watch and we follow, but sometimes it's something that we actually have to intervene on. And so the urinary tract just happens to be a location where things don't always go correctly.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes as physicians, there seems to be a connection between ear abnormalities and the urinary tract, probably because they're mm-hmm. both developing at very simultaneously. And so mm-hmm. as physicians or pediatricians anyway, we've been trained to mm-hmm. look at certain things and say, well, I wonder if there's also something inside that's a problem.
Sure, yeah. There are many things are going on about week 8 of life. As the kidneys are starting to develop, many structures in the midline are developing as well. And so sometimes a patient may have trouble with the heart, may have trouble with the esophagus, may have trouble with the ears, as you mentioned. They may have imperforate anus. They may have vertebral problems. They may have urinary tract problems. And it's not that one of these things have caused the other. It's that they're all occurring at the same time.
What are the types of illnesses or problems that are relatively common for you to be seeing? Let's see if we can enumerate some names of problems for people to establish.
Well, a very common condition is a urinary tract infection. Uh-huh. 8% of schoolgirls will get a urinary tract infection at some time, and so that's a very common presenting problem in children. Sometimes it's associated with underlying anatomical problems, and sometimes it's not. Along those lines, related to that, it may be a voiding disorder, mm-hmm. Another common problem, and that may range from daytime accidents to nocturnal enuresis. It may be a vesicoureteral reflux, another very common problem where urine backs up from the bladder to the kidney, and in the wrong setting, that may lead to problems with the kidney, such as renal scarring. Common anatomic problems are things like hypospadias, where the tube from the bladder, the urethra may not form correctly. We mentioned before, undescended testicles are a very common problem. Approximately 3% of boys are born with an undescended testicle. 2 out of those 3 will descend, but 1 out of 3 won't. And when that testicle doesn't come down, then oftentimes we need to put it down where it belongs, and put it where it will grow appropriately and where it will develop normally. Some of the more complicated and rarer things include intersex disorders. And both males and females are identical up until about that eighth week of life, as the genitals are forming. And if things don't go correctly, things may not progress adequately for male development, or they may proceed abnormally for female development.
Mm-hmm. So by intersex, just to clarify, those are issues where the sex of the child may be difficult to determine adequately and then may need some surgical of work to make it more functional.
Sure, sure. We can talk about it, but there's many different aspects of it. There's chromosomal sex, gonadal sex, where we actually talk about the actual gonads, the ovaries versus testes, the chromosomes, whether or not there is the proper chromosomal sex for the gender. Then we talk about what's called phenotypic sex, which is the actual appearance or the actual end state of development.
Okay. Yeah, those are a couple of words I think are important. Genotype is, when we talk about genotypic, it means this is what the chromosomes, this is what your genetic predisposition is, and it does not lead one-to-one to phenotype, which is what you look like. So people who have identical genotypes, twins, may at times look different for reasons for environmental impacts, for example, on that genotype. We have a caller in already, and I'd like to go ahead and take the questions. It seems like it's involving circumcision, and that's one of the things on our list anyway. Diane, you're on line one.
Hi, I have a question. I have an 11-year-old son, and at the time I could tell when he was born that the circumcision didn't seem correct, but that was confirmed 2 years ago when I had my younger son. And my question is, my older son seems to have urinary problems. He always seems to have to go to the bathroom. Could that be related?
Tell us what's different appearing about the circumcision.
Well, when both my sons seem to be the same sort of size, so yep. to speak,
yep.
and when my older son had his circumcision done, it's sort of upsetting, but it seemed to go in inward.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed
mm-hmm.
more of like a button than.
Yeah. So
do you understand what
yeah,
I'm saying?
And I'm butting in here, but I wanted to make sure that we got the issue. So what I'm thinking and what I think Dr. Bomolowski is seeing is you had the first child, you couldn't see the penis as well. It wasn't as long as in your second son. And you wonder if that has something to do with urinary tract problems at this point.
Right. He constantly has to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
And, you know, we have pictures when they were born. And,
right.
you know, they look pretty much the same.
Right.
But he had an older doctor do mm-hmm. the circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've heard, you know, from nurses that he wasn't the best at doing the mm-hmm. circumcision, and I didn't know that at the time. I was
okay.
23 when I had him. I didn't ask questions. So,
there may not be anything wrong. Let's see what Dr. Bomolowski has to say.
It's interesting. You know, circumcision is an interesting topic to discuss because there is so much social interest in it. And I think for many patients, circumcision is a social decision, and what we view as normal or abnormal in regards to circumcision may not necessarily be universally true. I think in this country, about 70% of boys are circumcised primarily for a social reason, but there are some that actually do gain a benefit from it. And as you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics, they have a statement in regards to circumcision that has changed over the years. And initially, they were much less in favor of it. And I think newer research has shown that there are some potential benefits to circumcision, primarily in relationship to infections early in life and probably sexually transmitted diseases later in life. In regards to your son, at his age, I would not expect a circumcision to have much influence in regards to infections. He's kind of beyond that initial stage during the first year of life where urinary tract infections can be more common in uncircumcised boys. And he's not at an age where I would think sexually transmitted diseases would be an issue. So he's kind of in that in-between age. And in regards to his going frequently, the question would be, is he having any sort of pain? Is he having any sort of inflammation? Is there irritation there? Probably not. Probably not. It would be unusual for his circumcision to be influencing his voiding patterns at this stage of the game. There may be cosmetic issues that are separate and distinct from that. And along those lines, I just want to mention, in this country, we do circumcisions a little bit differently than what they do in other countries. And in some countries, they do much less of a circumcision. In this country, we tend to do probably more of an extensive circumcision than they do other places. And so the actual cosmetic appearance may be entirely unrelated to any sort of medical or physical aspects going on.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering my question.
Yeah, Diane, let me just expand on that. I mean, it sounds to me like either some boys have a lot of prepubital fat just above their pubic bone. Their penis seems to sink in. That's one possibility that I think you may be describing. The other one is that there wasn't as much foreskin taken off, so more of the foreskin hangs down over the penis. And both of those issues, as Dr. Bobolowski is saying, it seems to be hard to understand how that could cause urinary tract problems per se. It may be more of an appearance and again, a coincidence between the two issues rather than a cause and effect.
Okay. Now, you mentioned cosmetically.
Right.
It doesn't seem he's starting to notice things mm-hmm. now. And I don't know really how to approach the subject. I have a doctor friend who's recommended that I have him see a urologist, but you're saying it's just coincidental that...
Well, he may. I suspect that his voiding pattern may be independent of his foreskin.
Okay.
And so, you know, if he were having inflammation, if he were having irritation, that may cause him to go more frequently. If he had blockage, and occasionally... even in a circumcised boy, there can be entrapment that can cause blockage and may influence his voiding patterns. But generally speaking, that's not very common.
All right. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. Well, let's jump on the circumcision issue since we're since we're there. And here's my 10 cents worth. Here's my opening bid on the circumcision. It appeared to me as a pediatrician, only in private practice in one place in my whole 30-plus years, that up to about 15 to maybe 20 years ago, it seemed to me this country, particularly the West Coast and maybe the East Coast, were moving towards more and more boys uncircumcised. And then a military physician, maybe an Air Force guy, says, you know, I just noticed and did a study where your circumcised boys had less urinary tract infections than circumcised, and suddenly it was a hard argument. So my 10 cents worth is I think it's still very much a social issue mm-hmm. that most Europeans are not circumcised, and they don't seem to have much problem with it, with being uncircumcised, so that except for a few clear religious reasons, I'm not so sure we need to be doing these circumcisions in the first place.
Well, I agree to a great extent, and I think the majority of circumcisions are done more because of social pressures. I think there are some children that do benefit, and you certainly do lower the risk of urinary tract infection in the first year of life. And so I think if a child is predisposed or has some other condition that may be seriously impacted, say they had an abnormality of the urinary tract to where if they had an infection, they were particularly at risk, that's a child that may potentially benefit. But mm-hmm. for the majority of boys, the majority of boys do fine without a circumcision. If you look at what is the incidence of circumcision in boys that are not circumcised in the newborn period, it's about 20%. So that means 4 out of 5 do fine. That also means, though, that 20% end up having problems with inflammation or adhesions or recurrent localized infections. We call that balanitis. Mm-hmm. And at some point, those boys come to circumcision for those type of problems. Some of the more interesting information, and when you're seeing a newborn, you're seeing a child, it's hard to translate that to later on in life. But there's some very interesting information coming from the World Health Organization in regards to AIDS in Africa. Right. And there have been some very interesting studies showing decreased transmission of sexually transmitted diseases in circumcised men versus uncircumcised men. And does that necessarily translate to the United States? Does it translate to we need to circumcise all newborn males? Absolutely not. But it's interesting information, and it shows that there are likely some benefits to be gained, and that's something that needs to be taken into consideration. Mm-hmm. The other concern is that it's not without risk. You know, it is a fairly straightforward procedure. It's has, I think, relatively low risk, but as we talked about social implications, as the woman who just called in, she has concerns, it sounds like, about the cosmetic appearance of her child, and she mentioned that the child was noticing it as well. And so, you know, there can be concerns about maybe localized, usually minor problems during the procedure, but if the cosmetic appearance isn't pleasing, then that's a concern as well. So it's not totally risk-free, and I think parents need to consider all aspects of it when they decide on whether their child should be circumcised.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And it's obviously something we're not going to change the national standard on. I remember, well, it's been 10 years ago, there was a two-part article in the New England Journal of Medicine. One was pro-circumcision, one was... So I kind of keep coming down. I think, to me, in my mind, the biggest risk, if you look at risk of doing it, risk of not, is the risk of circumcision is probably the most substantial risk of all the risks that we might talk about with and without circumcision. Is that...
I think most boys are going to do fine one way or the other.
Right. Okay.
One of the things I find is interesting is I get a fair number of adolescent boys that come in, and now they're in school, mm-hmm. and they're requesting it. And, they're the patient. And, when they request it, I think that carries some weight. And, I always have less trepidation about doing it at that point.
Before we leave, here's a not a terribly uncommon scenario. I'd like to see how you would approach it. Let's say we've got a 7, 8, 9, up to 11-year-old boy who does not have an easily retractable foreskin. The foreskin, just to put things in perspective, for most kids pretty early in life is very easily retractable and can be cleaned easily. But some kids, it's still kind of tight and hard to do. Is there a time for circumcision in those kids, and or what would you do prior to the circumcision if it came to your attention?
Well, I think it depends. Is the child having difficulty with it? Is he having entrapment of urine? Is mm-hmm. he having recurrent infections? Is he having this balanitis? What are the family's concerns? Would they like to try medical management? And sometimes you can use little topical steroids, and you can medically manage it, and that will oftentimes take care of it. And that's a very common European treatment for that.
Mm-hmm.
What does the child want? And again, as I mentioned, as the child gets older, what is his view on it? I think all those things need to be taken into consideration. For most boys, as they get older, they need to be able to adequately perform self-hygiene. It depends on, are there other problems or conditions going on with that child?
Okay. I want to remind our listeners again, this is Line 1. My guest is Dr. David Bomolowski. He's the only board-certified pediatric urologist in Alaska. He happens to be in Anchorage. He's been here about 18 months. And we're talking about urological disorders in the pediatric age group. So if you've got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. I want to take us back to that intrauterine environment for just a minute. You got a mother who has an ultrasound during pregnancy. They noticed that the calyces, the draining top of the drainage tube of the kidneys, which is in the kidneys, begins to dilate and is big. And you said some of these will resolve on their own, some won't. Tell us about the kind of the natural history of following these kids to make sure we do what's right, and why is it important to follow?
Well, the first thing to figure out is this affecting one kidney or both? in the prenatal period, the urine is a major contributor to the amniotic fluid. And if that amniotic fluid is not adequate, that can be life-threatening because that will affect things such as pulmonary development. So one of the primary questions is, are both kidneys affected? Is it one kidney? Is there adequate amniotic fluid? At least one kidney is normal. The next step then is once that child is born, what is going on? Is it that that kidney did not develop normally in regards to the actual working part, the parenchyma? Is it cystic? There is a condition called a multicystic dysplastic kidney. It's primarily a kidney that never formed normally, and so it's dysplastic. Is it dilated because there is blockage? And there can be blockage at any number of spots. One common place is called the ureteropelvic junction, and that's where that kidney drains into that ureter. There may be blockage lower down. There may be blockage at the level of the bladder, and that can be from what's called an obstructed megaureter. There can be what's called a ureteroseal, where that tube didn't form normally at the bladder. There may be dilation because there's reflux, because urine is backing up from that bladder up to the kidney. There may be dilation because that bladder is not working normally. That bladder itself may have outlet obstruction, such as posterior urethral valves or congenital blockage of that urethra, and that back pressure is affecting the kidney. And so the primary thing to determine is what is the cause of that dilation. In many children, they will have a degree of dilation which is mild or moderate, and it will spontaneously improve. And in many things in medicine, sometimes the real question is determining who needs intervention and who does not. And we now know that many things will correct with time, and so about 80% of dilated kidneys will improve. About 20% will not, and about 20% will progress. And if that obstruction progresses, then renal damage can occur. The other thing is that dilated kidney may predispose towards infection, sometimes severe infection or even life-threatening infection. And so it's important to evaluate it and try and judge what is the cause, what is the severity, what's the treatment plan.
In general, when that's first noted in a prenatal ultrasound, which we have that advantage now, I have to say, because before prenatal ultrasounds, we often didn't find that a child had some of these, perhaps in particular the very bad forms, until we were really in some trouble. There were no symptoms.
Sure, yeah. Before prenatal ultrasounds, many of these children presented with severe infections, with right. sepsis, right. even septic shock.
Right. So now we can see that, and we don't generally, certainly in the Anchorage, have the ability, or very few people anywhere, even do anything in utero. But right after birth, then there's a period of following or some testing that's done to try to identify exactly mm-hmm. what the reason. And the reasons could dictate treatment or not treatment, depending on what's being found is the reason.
Absolutely. One of the first things that we want to do when the child is born is, assess, again, as I mentioned, what else is going on? Are there other problems going on? Are there other are the lungs okay? Are there electrolyte abnormalities? Because the kidney's primary function is to filter the blood. Are we concerned that filter is going to be adequate? You want to repeat the ultrasound and confirm what was seen prenatally, because oftentimes the prenatal ultrasound may not have the detail that you can get postnatally. We want to determine, is there a reflux? What's going on with the rest of the urinary tract? Is that bladder okay? Is there any sort of bladder outlet obstruction? If there is dilation, oftentimes it's something that we can watch. And several weeks down the road, once that kidney has had just a little bit of maturation, we may want to do what's called a renal scan. And that's a test where we can evaluate the function. With the kidneys, we're lucky. We oftentimes have one normal kidney when we're looking at a kidney that may have some problems. And so we can do a test and we can compare it. Does it have equal function to the opposite side? Does it drain as well as the opposite side? So we've got a built-in control. And based upon those tests, we may decide, gosh, we need to do something about it, or we don't need to do something about it, or we need to continue to follow it to make that determination.
In these individuals who have very significant, you use the term vesicoureteral reflux, which means urine, instead of going out of the body when the bladder contracts, may go back up, retrograde in the urethras up towards the kidneys. Obviously, those individuals may have trouble with infection, but they also have significant pressure. And then I guess what I'm getting at is what are the potential complications? I want people to understand that this is not particularly good for the kidneys for this to be going on.
Well, you know, reflux is a very common problem, and it's been studied in thousands and thousands of kids around the world. And there have been even a couple international reflux study groups in trying to look at it. And you can grade reflux, or the severity of it, from grade 1 to 5. Where 1 is minimal and 5 is very severe. And that grade is important because it will determine whether or not this is something that will correct on its own or whether it's something that is not likely to correct on its own. The trouble with reflux is it allows a bladder infection to become a kidney infection. And bladder infections aren't any fun, but over the long run, they generally will not hurt the child. A kidney infection, on the other hand, may cause scarring and may be significant. It may impact renal function, and a kidney infection is much more severe. It's more of a systemic infection. And so the grade of reflux gives us a prognostic indicator, and it also helps determine what needs to be done, what are the options. Is this something, again, that we can watch and let self-correct? Is this something that we need to intervene? And if we do need to intervene, how do we intervene?
And the reason we know whether we can follow something or not is not just an individual physician's experience. It's from these multiple studies that have been done, and it becomes clear that the risk increases the worse the reflux grade, as well as the reason for it, I'm assuming. I'm not the expert on this, but there's multiple factors. And so, you know... good physicians know all those statistics, and that's one reason why a pediatric urologist may know the answer easier than an adult urologist to this particular question.
Well, I think it's twofold. One is when you have, say, grade 5 reflux, where you've got a massively dilated system, that kidney has a lot of built-in stasis. It doesn't tend to flush out quite as well. It doesn't have effective peristalsis, where that bolus of urine can go down that ureter to the bladder. And so it's going to have a disadvantage in regards to combating infection and preventing infection. The other thing is that degree of reflux may be indicative of a developmental abnormality at that time. As we discussed before, the kidneys develop very early in life, around week 8. And that grade 5 reflux may be associated with underlying dysplasia. That kidney may not be at 100% from the start. And so when you add infection on top of that, you may take an already compromised kidney and cause it to be even more compromised. And on the other hand, a grade 1 reflux is just a little bit of reflux into that ureter. And most of us would just follow that, because that's a child that's going to self-correct. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to intervene. And then when you talk the grades 2, 3, 4, again, it's a matter of where do we draw the line? How is that child doing? What are the other issues going on in regards to that patient that may make us either follow it or intervene?
Okay. Let's go on down. Let's exit the bladder. We've been the kidney, down the ureters, into the bladder a little bit. Now we're talking about the urethra, the exit from the bladder. What are some of the common abnormalities? You've mentioned some obstruction from the outside of the bladder and something called posterior urethral valves. And I want to talk about epispadias and hypospadias. So.
Sure. Well, posterior urethral valves are a leaflet of tissue that may form in males, doesn't occur in females, only will occur in males, and they may cause obstruction to that bladder. And it's a spectrum, as many of the things we've been discussing. As we talked about reflux, it's a spectrum. Many of these conditions are a spectrum. And some patients with posterior valves have severe long-standing obstruction from early in life, and some have a much lesser degree of obstruction. About a third of boys with posterior valves will actually be born with renal insufficiency. About a third of them will have progression of renal insufficiency later on in life, and about a third of them will not have any sort of renal implications to the valves. But it's an important thing to pick up. Because it's something that may progress throughout life. And if it's missed early, it can have implications later on in life.
And symptoms?
Well, people talk about a valve bladder. Just as older men who have obstruction from the prostate tend to get changes in their bladder, a infant with posterior valves may already have some changes in his bladder. He may have a bladder that is less compliant. It doesn't tend to relax and hold urine as well. He may have a bladder that has more collagen in it and may not squeeze as well. And so the function of the bladder is to both store and empty urine. In a bladder that is very fibrotic, it does neither of those things very well. It doesn't relax to store and it doesn't squeeze to empty. And so that may have further implications for the kidneys later on in life, as I mentioned before. And so there are several different ramifications of valves, both from their impact on renal function to their impact on infections to their impact on continence.
I was taught, I don't know that I've ever seen posterior urethral valves since I've been out in practice, so maybe I'm missing them, but now, as you said, there's multiple degrees, that one of the primary things was the infant boy who really dribbles from the get-go, never has a good stream. I mean, that suggests there's something keeping urine from getting out. Is that still a common manifestation, or again, because of this gradation, you could miss that?
Well, certainly it can be. Again, you know, we're lucky because we have prenatal ultrasounds on so many children, and that's the primary way it is picked up. Now, having said that, I have seen a number of older children where valves is picked up later on in life, and that is a reason, I think, why a child with a urinary tract infection needs to be evaluated, because there may be some underlying problem or issue, and you have to figure out what, you know, could it be related to something severe like that, or is this something not to worry about?
But epispadias, hypospadias, what do those terms mean? What are we talking about?
Epi means above, hypo below, and it has to do with how the urethra has formed. And if that urethra doesn't form completely, if the opening of that urethra is above the penis, then it's called epispadias, and that's usually associated with bladder extrophy or abnormal development of that bladder. Hypospadias, on the other hand, generally is not associated with any sort of bladder abnormality, and that's where the urethra doesn't form completely below the penis. And hypospadias is much more common. As we mentioned earlier in the show, males and females phenotypically look similar. They look very similar in utero, and the way the penis and the urethra form is by fusion of the essentially the labia minora. Those labioscrotal folds fuse, and they may not fuse completely. They start proximally or work their way distally out to the tip of the penis, and that fusion sometimes is not complete. And if that's the case, the child has hypospadias. It may manifest as that urethral opening anywhere along the shaft of that penis, from proximal to distal. Distal is fortunately much more common than proximal, and it's usually a less severe defect to have. But it is something that needs to be repaired. I see a number of children with hypospadias, and I tell the family we really have three goals here. One goal is we want this child to think of himself as the rest of the boys, and to think of himself as normal. And certainly there are a lot of psychosocial issues when you deal with the genitalia. And so I think that's a very critical aspect The other thing is we want to be sure that that male child can avoid standing. That's something that, again, is socially important. And finally, we want to be sure the child has an adequate penis for intercourse later in life. And sometimes there can be associated problems with the erectile tissue as well. They can have cordy or bending of that penis. And so those are three goals. And for that reason, hypospadias is something that definitely needs to be fixed.
Okay. And back to a relationship between circumcision and the hypospadias. Sometimes these problems may not be noticed until the circumcision is done.
Yeah. It's an interesting condition called a megameatus intact prepuce. And that is where that prepuce is covering up the distal urethra. And it's not until that circumcision is done that you actually see that development wasn't quite complete. Now, fortunately, that's a distal hypospadias, and it can be fixed even after the circumcision, and it's not that much more technically challenging. In a proximal hypospadias, oftentimes that prepuce is actually used for the repair. Mm. And so in that condition, you definitely don't want to do a circumcision until the hypospadias is corrected and the circumcision is done at the same time.
Let me remind our listeners once more, we got about 10, 15 minutes, and we're talking about urologic conditions involving the kidney, the ureter, the bladder, the penis, and we're going to talk about the testicle in a minute, in children and pediatric age groups. So if you've got questions or comments or experiences you want to share, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And also another way to get a hold of us is to email me directly during the next couple of minutes at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Let's talk about testicles, and particularly how about undescended testicles? You've mentioned that before. It's another common issue I know in pediatrics, and when's it important? How do we manage those things?
Well, the testicles actually form up by the kidneys, and is approximately the seventh month of gestation, they traverse the abdominal wall, go through the inguinal canal, and go into the scrotum. About 3% of term male babies will have undescended testicles. And about 2 out of those 3 will come on down in the first 6 months of life. There's a hormone surge shortly after birth, and that may stimulate final descent of those testicles. But we know that that after that 6 months of life, that if those testicles have not come down, that they won't descend any further than at that point. And we also know that if that testicle is not in the proper location, it may not develop normally. And there's been some interesting studies looking at the histology of undescended testicles versus descended testicles, and they can start to see change in spermatogonia, or the primitive cells that go on to form sperm later in life, after about 18 months. And so you get a change in the number of spermatogonia. The reason the testicles are in the scrotum is it regulates the temperature, and that temperature is important for testicular development. So generally, if that testicle is not down, then it should be brought down 6 months to a year of life.
Okay. All right, may want to come back to some issues on that, but we have a caller, and I want to make sure we get that. Bonnie, you're on line one.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My daughter was diagnosed with a Mullerian duct anomaly at 13. We didn't know about it until then. She began menstruating, and then difficulties appeared, and a very forward-thinking OBGYN was able to figure out what was going on. In the process of this, we discovered she had only one kidney. Mm-hmm. And, we had ultrasound before she was born, and our GP provided what I think was good care throughout her childhood. Was there something we should have been looking for, or,
yeah.
It came as quite a shock to us.
Sure.
Yeah. Going back to embryology, the kidney goes through several stages of development. The final stage is called the mesonephros, and that mesonephric duct stimulates the internal genital ducts, the Wolfian duct and the Mullerian duct. And the Wolfian duct forms the male internal genitalia. The Mullerian duct forms the female. And so, as mentioned before, all these things are going on at the same time. There is a sequential order early in life in regards to the kidney and the genital ducts. And when one thing doesn't occur, it may not stimulate that next step.
Mm-hmm.
In males, with if the vas deferens is missing, they may have an absent kidney as well. And again, it has to do with that that mesonephros and that Wolfian duct and that Mullerian duct all being dependent upon each other for stimulation for the next stage in development. It is not uncommon for females, if they have a vaginal abnormality, to also have a renal abnormality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is this genetic?
Generally not. There are some genetic syndromes associated with vaginal agenesis. There are some genetic syndromes associated with hormone receptor abnormalities. Probably not in your daughter's case.
Well, the reason I ask is that I had a constricted urethra as an infant, which was discovered at about age one, and a chronic kidney infection that lasted until I was 16 and sulfa drugs came on the market and that took care of it. And so I just thought it was kind of curious that I had this issue and then she had this issue.
Yeah, it is. I suspect that the problems probably were unrelated, though. I think your daughter's problem was probably related, again, to early organogenesis, to those events not going correctly at that point in time. Literally the second week of or second month of fetal life.
Right.
And probably your condition, there used to be a common treatment for urinary tract infection in girls was urethral dilation. Probably not done as much anymore as it used to be, but that was certainly a fairly common method of treatment in the past. Probably these are unrelated.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
Let me ask you a question. You said your daughter's 13 years old, and I'm trying to think back how long we've been doing prenatal ultrasounds. Did you have an ultrasound while you were pregnant with her?
I did.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you know what?
But it didn't show up.
Yeah.
Do you know what week they did that? Any idea?
You know, it's been a long time ago. She's 19 now. I don't remember.
Sure. You know, I think we forget that how small that fetus may be, and you really can't pick up the kidneys until about 18 to 20 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
What they are more likely to see is if there is a dilated kidney versus a kidney that did not develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say also from a physician standpoint who's taking care of your daughter, there would be probably no outward manifestations of problems unless she started having urinary tract infections or some unusual vaginal discharge or something like that. So
yeah, well, she had some corrective surgery at the time that this was discovered.
And sure.
Was it, yeah, if you don't mind my asking, was it a septum that they found or a bicornate uterus?
Yeah. So they removed it down the middle of the cervix, but of course the uterus is still divided.
Sure. And that again, has to do with how those ducts induced each other to develop.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. Thanks for your program.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks for your call. All right. So back to these testicle guys that are descending through your abdomen and so forth. So 6 months of age, I don't feel any on my patient in front of me. Now what?
Well, I think it may mean a couple things. It may mean that testicle is intra-abdominal, and about 20% of undescended testicles will be intra-abdominal. About 5% will be absent, so there may not be a testicle there. It may be at 6 months of age, retractile testicles aren't that much of an issue, but certainly as that child gets a little bit older, you know, 3, 4, 5, the testicles may become retractile, and that is where that testicle has a very active, what we call cremasteric reflex. The that testicle draws up very easily and doesn't tend to stay down in the scrotum. But at 6 months of age, if it can't be felt, then a couple things probably should be done. Probably a testicular ultrasound at that point in time is reasonable. They may or may not be able to confirm that there is a testicle in the inguinal canal. If that testicle is not located in the inguinal canal, they may not see it on ultrasound. And probably that's a child that needs to have laparoscopy, and that's a relatively new, minimally invasive technique that's been around for about 15, 20 years, and where we can put a small little scope, literally the size of an ink cartridge inside a pen, and you can put it in through the umbilicus or belly button, and you can take a look. Is there a testicle sitting there in the abdomen? And that's important to know, because if there is an intra-abdominal testicle, it has a risk of cancer. Undescended testicles have about a 20 to 30 times higher rate of cancer than a descended testicle. It's not the overall risk is still relatively low, about 1 to 2% lifetime risk. But if there is an abdominal testicle, we need to know about it. We need to either get that testicle into the scrotum where it can grow and do its normal functions and be examined throughout life by that patient, or it should be removed. And as I said earlier in the show, the testicles form up by the kidneys, and that testicle may be located anywhere between that scrotum and the kidney, and you need to know.
Another problem often in the immediate newborn period is a mass or a swelling in the scrotum. Often it's a collection of fluid we call a hydrocele. Do you want to talk about the importance of that?
Sure. When the testicles descend, they bring down some of the lining from the abdomen along with them. Actually, it descends right in front of the testicle and precedes the testicle down into the scrotum. And we call that lining the tunica vaginalis. That tunica vaginalis oftentimes will close off. That testicle has had to traverse the abdominal wall, and where it traverses normally will close off. It may not. And all males have a little bit of fluid around the testicle. If that testicle has too much fluid, we call it a hydrocele, which is a fairly common condition in infants. If there is a communication, then it's a communicating hydrocele or an indirect inguinal hernia. That's a little more concerning when there is a communication. You want to be sure that it's not going to manifest as a symptomatic hernia, which can potentially be an emergency. If it is non-communicating, then usually it'll resorb on its own. It may take up to a couple of years of life, but usually that's something that we just follow. And again, it's a condition that we now know will get better on its own.
We've got 5 or 6 minutes, and I'm thinking in my own mind, what's the most important? And I guess I would go to voiding disorders, particularly, again, we seem to be picking on boys, but in these disorders, I was thinking when we were thinking about this show, it seems like there's a disproportionate number of boy problems. But boys are notorious for bedwetting late into their life. And so let's talk about voiding disorders.
About 1% of 15-year-olds will still have trouble at night. About 20% of 5-year-olds will still have trouble at night. There can be a number of reasons for it. I think it's important to try and sort out, is this associated with more concerning problems? Is this associated with daytime accidents which are of more of a concern than nocturnal enuresis? Is this associated with urinary tract infections? Those things may be an indication that there's a more severe underlying problem with the urinary tract. Primary nocturnal enuresis is generally not something that is medically concerning so much as it's a social issue, and it can be a significant social issue. Makes it very difficult for that child to have sleepovers, and certainly as that child gets older, it can be a significant issue. I've even occasionally seen some college-age kids still having trouble. When a baby is first born, their bladder fills up and empties, and there's no thought process involved in that. The bladder function doesn't disrupt sleep. So learning to wake with a full bladder is a learned skill. And some people develop that later in life than others. Additionally, the number of voids that a child makes decreases as that child gets older. And so an older child will have a bladder which will hold more urine and empty less frequently. Combined on that, we all make a hormone called vasopressin, and that vasopressin has a circadian rhythm that decreases the amount of urine that we make at night. And so there are several things then that contribute to being continent at night. One is your body has that hormone which decreases the amount of urine. Two, as you get older, your bladder will hold more and have fewer uninhibited contractions. And three, you have that arousal mechanism where you recognize when your bladder is full. And the treatment of nocturnal enuresis works on all of those different pathways. One common way is we sometimes give a little bit extra of that vasopressin. That DDAVP, as its brand name, to decrease the amount of urine that's made. Sometimes we will recommend bed alarms that help that child learn to wake before they've had a complete bladder accident to try and stimulate that arousal mechanism. Sometimes we'll give some medications to decrease those uninhibited contractions, and so. There are treatments for it, and probably the most important thing, though, is to ensure there's no other associated issues which may be an indication of more severe underlying problems.
Okay. Give me 20 seconds on variceal. This is the other end of the boys the infants.
Variceal is essentially varicose veins in the scrotum. They're dilated veins in the scrotum, and as mentioned before, the scrotum is important for regulating testicular temperature for adequate testicular growth. In adolescence, we worry about varicoceles if they're affecting testicular growth because that may impact future fertility.
So that's a problem that's sometimes not noted until adolescence that may need to be managed.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks very much. Quick hour.
It's been my pleasure.
Enjoyed it very much. My thanks today to Dr. David Bobulaski. We've talked about pediatric urology. Don't forget to go to our website, kska.org/line1, and look at web resources if you have more questions. Next week, we're going to be talking about negative thinking, anxiety with Dr. Tamar Chansky. She's been on before. She's an expert in adolescent anxiety, depression, and obsessive compulsive disorder. Tune into your health and learn more next Monday, January 5th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.